You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello everyone and welcome to another History of the Great War interview. This is the second in the series of interviews with the authors of the Great War Group Introduction series of books. This time I was joined by Chris Sams to discuss his book, Early Cruiser Warfare. It covers most of the early cruiser actions around the world, with the events of Von Spee's squadron and the Emden playing large parts of that story. In the lead-up to the war, there were serious concerns in the Royal Navy about enemy surface raiders, which would attack the trade routes around the world as soon as the war began. There were certain German ships stationed around the world that had the ability to do this, and much of the concern of the Grand Fleet in the North Sea revolved around preventing a larger breakout of enemy ships into the Atlantic. When the war started, these concerns would prove to be legitimate, if maybe a bit exaggerated. We discussed the adventures of Admiral Maximilian von Spee way back in episode 48, and he would take the East Asia Squadron, comprised of the Scharnhorst, Gneisenau, Leipzig, and Nürnberg, on a fantastic voyage across the entire length of the Pacific. They would be met off the west coast of South America by a force of Royal Navy ships, and in the Battle of the Coronel that followed, the German ships would be victorious. Von Spee had a problem, though. His goal was to try and get back to Europe. And this meant that no matter what happened, he would almost certainly be attacked by the Royal Navy on that route home. This would then occur at the Battle of the Falkland Islands, which would see all of the German ships sank by the far superior British forces, including 2 battlecruisers. One ship that was initially part of the East Asia Squadron that did not make the trip across the Pacific was the Emden, which would move into the Indian Ocean to begin a raiding expedition that would last from August 14th to November 9th, 1914. The story of the Emden, its exploits, and its eventual destruction would be front page news all over the world during the 2 months that it evaded the Royal Navy's attempts to contain it. This publicity was, honestly, probably far in excess of the actual impact that the cruiser would have on the course of the war. But I think it is understandable why it was such a popular story, given how easy it was to kind of understand what was happening with the Emden and what it was doing. While at the same time, the events in Europe were just a confusing mix of place names many people around the world had never heard of. After the end of the Emden's spree in the Indian Ocean, most of the cruiser warfare would be at an end for the rest of the war, simply due to the fact that the resources that the German Navy had at war were exhausted. If you would like to learn far more about the experiences of cruisers during the early part of the war, check out Chris Sams' book with the link in the episode description, or just head on over to greatwargroup.com. Hello everyone and welcome to another History of the Great War interview. Today I'm joined by Chris Sams, the author of Early Cruiser Warfare, one of the Great War Group's introduction books that are coming out soon-ish, or they could already be out by the time this is released. The release date seems a little fuzzy. Chris Sams, welcome to the interview, and thank you for joining me today. Yeah. Okay, so you wrote a book about early cruiser warfare in the First World War. What has drawn you to this topic? What made you want to write a book about it?
It's not as an interesting way. I worked at the Imperial War Museum in the security department, and that would often mean getting up really early to go to work. So catching the train at like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was reading through Wikipedia And it, you know, they give you the subjects you might be interested in. And it had it came up with the Emden, 4:30 in the morning, sitting in a train tunnel. Like, yeah, I'll read that. And then I went from there on to Von Spee, the Falklands, Coronel, into everything else. And then we had the centenaries. And so I started to try and live blog, or at least get the anniversaries for like all the battles and what everyone was doing. And then I ended up writing a book about it in 2015. On because I'd written all these blogs and I just thought, oh, I wonder if I can. Someone was trawling through Facebook looking for authors, and they said, "Oh, we're trying to get someone in the Second World War." I said, "What about First World War early cruisers?" And they went, "Send us a proposal." And so I did that, and yeah, I've kind of got stuck with them. It's become my happy place.
I definitely feel like there's a whole generation of historians. A lot of them are probably still younger at this point, that sort of had their sort of Genesis light bulb moment randomly reading on Wikipedia at some point, and that's what got their ball going.
Absolutely, kind of hooks you, and then you just find yourself going, oh, that's interesting, and you disappear down a rabbit hole following all the links and things. And
uh-huh. It's fantastic. So when we're looking at cruiser warfare, specifically at cruiser warfare, sort of in the years before the First World War, how did the German Imperial Navy think that they were going to use these cruisers that they had? And did they have any kind of concrete plans about what would happen? Or were they just sort of broad commerce rating guidelines? We'll see how it goes.
I think it's probably more the latter. I mean, I don't think anyone really thought that they would be fighting everyone at once in Europe in 1914. But for the Germans, the biggest enemy was going to be the Royal Navy, so they had to maintain the balance in the North Sea, which meant that all the good capital ships, like the battle cruisers and battleships, were going to be in the North Sea. There was no two ways about it; they had to be there. They also needed ships out in Asia, in Tsingtao, and for policing the imperial holdings or the islands. And again, Dar es Salaam in Africa, East Africa. That was mainly to annoy the British after the Boer War, because Germany tried to rattle the saber during the Boer War, but the solitary unprotected cruiser was massively outclassed by all the British ships that turned up. So having Königsberg there was a step up. They knew when they were going to be at war with Britain that the ships in the East Asian squadron and the African squadrons weren't going to be enough to defeat to win a campaign. Britain outnumbered them. Britain outgunned them. So the idea of commerce raiding was basically hedging your bets in a way. If you can take your guns off and put them on civilian ships, you can do more damage over a larger area. And so it was hoped that they would try and do as much damage as possible. And with the Schlieffen plan, ultimately the war was going to be over by Christmas. So all von Spee would have to do was hold in the Ostasian Geschwader would be to hold out till Christmas. So I think it was kind of hoped if we do as much damage as possible, and hopefully our boys will come home at the end of it. If not, we can cause the British, if it can force the British to bleed ships off from the North Sea, that will give us then the advantage in that bit. And then we can hit them in the big naval battle that never came.
So they have these kind of ships and these far-flung squadrons. What are some of the like basic characteristics of the cruisers in these squadrons? What kind of guns do they have? What is their, range and things like that?
Mostly the light cruisers were. So in the East Asian squadron, that'd be the Emden, Leipzig, Nuremberg, and Königsberg, which was Nuremberg's sister off Africa. They were armed mostly with 10-inch, not 10-inch guns, that'd be hilariously bad. What am I saying? 10-centimeter guns, that's what I was trying to say. They had a rough speed of about 20 knots. But for the biggest ships abroad, not including one in the Mediterranean, but in Asia would be the Scharnhorst class armored cruisers. So they had 8.3-inch guns, 6 5.9-inch guns, 18 3.5-inch guns, 4 torpedo tubes, and had a top speed of around 22.5 knots, which made them fairly big fish in that small pond. But the British had the Australia, which was the battle cruiser, which could single-handedly take out Von Space Squadron on its own at range. They also had 2 pre-dreadnought battleships, which used that people say the term pre-dreadnought, they think old and rubbish. They weren't that old, and they had a massive amount of firepower. And against a dreadnought, they wouldn't do too well, but against 2 armored cruisers and some light cruisers, so Britain had the Triumph and the Swiftsure nearby as well. So the Germans were outgunned, but the light cruisers gave speed and range as well for the squadron. So it was quite a decent mix. The Mediterranean squadron, which I won't talk about too much, had the battle cruiser Goeben, which was a huge problem for the British, and the light cruiser Breslau. The Goeben, like the Australia, could take out a British fleet that didn't have battle cruisers on its own at range and keep sailing around them, so they couldn't be caught, couldn't get into torpedo range and just take them apart.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned the like comparisons between pre-dreadnoughts and dreadnoughts during this period, because it's not like there's a long period. It's like 1 year they're making pre-dreadnoughts, that 2 years later it's all dreadnoughts. And so there's a lot of ships out there in the world at this time that are of the pre-dreadnought vintage. And so, you know, having a couple or describing something like that doesn't mean it is totally useless.
Oh, absolutely. And you've also get like the Deutschland class pre-dreadnoughts coming out after Dreadnought had been completed. And in England, the Lord Nelsons, they were still being built when Dreadnought was built. So that ultimately, as soon as they rolled into the sea, they were obsolete, which is a bit crazy. So they're often referred to as semi-dreadnoughts to kind of appease people.
Yeah. You didn't totally waste your money. You just mostly wasted your money.
Yeah, exactly.
We talked about a little bit about the German ships here, but let's look at the British. So the British had to know that this was kind of going to happen in some way. So what was kind of their plan to combat surface raiders, just in general, like the cruisers that we're looking at here?
Britain tried to solve the situation, to crack the nut with a sledgehammer in a way that, and they tried to flood as many ships as possible to try and catch these raiders as quickly as possible. In Asia, I'm not a big fan of Churchill at all in this period, or at all. And he, I've said this before in a previous interview, that with the he's playing chess, so he can see where all his ships are. He doesn't necessarily know where the Germans are, but he can see the bigger picture. Whereas the admirals on the ground can only see what they're doing. And in Asia, you get the Australian government are trying to control Admiral Patey's squadron. And Admiral Jerome decides to set off quickly before Churchill can give him some orders. And their idea is, if we can get rid of the German bases, or if we can catch the German fleet at sea, we can destroy it, get it done, all done, and then we can take the islands and all the safe havens, etc., at our leisure. Whereas the Australians decide, well, let's just take the ports. Let's get rid of their ports and their safe havens now. Off the coast of Southern America, you can't take the ports because they're neutral countries. So it's just a matter of having British ships cruising up and down, looking for possible safe havens and listening for wireless chatter. Because although wireless is great and you can send messages to loads of people, to other ships and organize meetings and stuff with supply ships, you can also someone else can hear you, triangulate your position, work out where you are, and then turn up. Which happened to the Karlsruhe when she stopped a British ship. A liner went past and signaled. It was a Spanish liner went past and signaled them and said, "What's going on here?" And they said, "Oh, we're a British ship. We're doing a routine inspection." And the Spanish liner said, "Oh, okay, no problem." And HMS Canopus, that was further away, another pre-dreadnought, sent a signal saying, "What's going on?" They said, "Oh, there's a British ship." And they said, "Which one?" And the Karlsruhe went, "Oh crap!" So they quickly sank the British ship and sailed away. And by the time the battleship got there was no one there. But that was an example of where wireless goes wrong.
So I'm assuming they also had to use wireless to coordinate, supplies. These are coal-fired ships, and I'm assuming they did not carry enough coal to go all the way across the Pacific like they would end up doing in the case of the Von Spee squadron.
Well, Von Spee actually did. Right at the beginning, because he was quite... His Scharnhorst and Neisenau were already out of Tsingtao port. They were already on a flying the flag mission. And so they sent a signal saying all German ships, colliers and whatever, meet us at this island, whose name I suddenly can't remember. I keep getting them muddled up sometimes. But he called all German ships to him and as many colliers as possible. And they loaded, they actually stacked the decks of the cruise, of the armored cruisers and the light cruisers with as much coal as they could, as well as what was in the coal supply and the coal bunkers. And then they had colliers as well. The problem for Von Spee was they then got caught in a tropical storm, which washed a good chunk of the coal overboard, as well as all the livestock that they had penned up on the decks as well. But they would basically suck a collier dry, then send it off to try and get more coal from a neutral port on the off chance, but fully expecting that they would never come back. But they managed to get enough coal to get most of the way across the Pacific without resupplying.
Interesting. So
traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I think a lot of history kind of focuses on the journey of some of these cruisers, especially the Von Spee squadron, but like their purpose was commerce raiding. So, you know, what was kind of their record of success when it comes to commerce raiding? I know that the Emden in the Indian Ocean was maybe the most successful.
Yeah, Emden was prolific. I forget the number. I want to say 22 to 24 ships off the top of my head. They were really quite fortunate as well. They also sank two. I think that includes two warships that they sank. They had some quite happy spells where they managed to catch like 3-4 ships in a handful of days. So the other cruiser that was really successful was the Karlsruhe, who had a very similar number to Emden. But her career is less talked about because they were less gung-ho. I mean, von Müller would just like sailed into Madras Harbour and started shelling and Dang Harbour and sank a Russian cruiser. With the Karlsruhe, it had more of a gradual approach because it was in much more dangerous waters. So they would put a collier on either side and drift up the trade spine with the idea that the colliers would up the field of vision so they'd be able to see further. And they just listened to the wireless chatter, and the career was really quite successful. But they came to an unfortunate end. They had they exploded, possibly due to an ammunition storage. No one's quite sure. They were sailing up the Caribbean to cause trouble there, and she just blew up and took 2/3 of the crew down with her. But that was also quite a successful one. The Leipzig off the western coast of America was less successful. She only sank 2 ships, but her mere presence was enough to cause massive panic in Canada. They thought there was going to be an invasion because the Canadian Navy only had these the very old HMCS Rainbow to stopper, which didn't have proper ammunition the first time it put to sea. And a lot of British flag shipping didn't want to go to sea where they could get caught by a German cruiser. And so it actually froze trade between San Francisco and Vancouver, which ended up with all the docks filling up with wood and foodstuffs that wasn't being moved. The Dresden was also similarly less prolific, but they were fleeing from the Royal Navy, so they kind of went down the coast of South America, set up the hidden base at Trinidad, and then went around to join Von Spee Squadron.
I guess just the mere existence of these ships was could be powerful, even if they were actually not capturing or sinking very many enemy merchant vessels.
Absolutely. I mean, the Königsberg, I've just remembered the Königsberg this is technically a treason in this country. They captured the city of Winchester, which was coming from India to through the Red Sea, and it was carrying the first of the tea harvest. So they sank this ship with all the tea leaves on it. The British Admiralty then said, well, the Red Sea's got a German cruiser in it. There's no civilian traffic can go through the Red Sea, which then stopped tea delivery to England, that's awful. So the first of the tea harvest was late coming to London in 1914, just because one cruiser sank one ship.
That's really interesting. I was just the other day, I was reading a really interesting article about in the Second World War. So you know, a little bit later, all the things that were done to try and make sure that stuff like tea was still available because it was so important to civilian morale during the conflict.
Oh, absolutely. I had a crisis the other day. I ran out of tea here. I'm like, oh God, what am I going to do? I imagine how the nation would have felt.
So one of the things I think is really hard to kind of picture is that, you know, these ships are just out there and really dependent on like random wireless signals and stuff. Or are they just kind of hanging out in sort of mostly known ship routes, hoping to find something?
They knew where a lot of the trade spines would meet, and they set up areas where they could go and had like secret supply bases set up nearby where they could just sort of take the ships they've caught and move them there. With the Karlsruhe, they used to if they caught a collier, they would take it off the trade spine and put it in a secret bay and then just go and ravage it over weeks, as much coal of it out as possible before sinking it. But they knew where all the trade spines were. But the problem was, so did the British. So it was kind of a cat and mouse of, we'll stay here for as long as it's safe and then we'll move on. Because as ships start to go missing, the British will then go, well, there's something going on here. And so they'd go up and check it. The Emden had that problem where after a very successful run, they went to Madras, fired in Madras, and then they moved round and found up towards Ceylon, and they found that the British were just keeping all the ships in port. So they had to come off the trade routes for a period of time and then go back to it. The same, the Leipzig as well, went off South America and went to the Galapagos Islands for a week. And because she disappeared, the British shipping started moving again. And with Von Spee Squadron, they just keep going. Von Spee doesn't feel that trade warfare like that is beneath the role of an Imperial German admiral. It's basically piracy. So he it's not what his ships are there for. But he, as well, which is a bit very noble of him. But again, you have that with the liners that they've rebuilt. They've repurposed, like the Crown Prince Wilhelm, and the later the Prince Eitel Friedrich. They sort of stick to Prince Eitel Friedrich goes up the sailing spine because they figure that none of them will have wireless, so that they're a bit freer to. And also, if a ship goes missing on the sailing route, no one will notice because they already take months to get anywhere. So by the time they realise they're overdue, Prince Eitel Friedrich will have gone through.
A lot of these sort of ships, they eventually get caught or they eventually get destroyed, one way or the other. did the Germans judge them to be a success when they were kind of evaluating, you know, the resources spent on them and then their part in the war?
No. Well, yes and no, because they did carry out what they were supposed to.
I'm going to have to ask you to restart. We got yes and no, and then you were talking for a bit, and then you came back.
No problem. Yes and no, because they did carry out the duties that they were supposed to. I think with the regular warships, they were more than happy that the German crews had discharged their duties. Von Spee's squadron had successfully defeated the British fleet at Coronel, the first Royal Navy fleet defeat since the Napoleonic War. They had put in a really good show to get as far as they did. They were butchered at the Falklands because the British were up the game. Said, right, we're going to get rid of you. This is it. Game over. Same with the Königsberg. She walled herself in. There was nothing she could have done, and they just sat there and waited. Waited in the Refugee River, and they held down a British fleet till March. With the liners, they realised that they weren't ideal for the kind of war that they'd hoped they would do. The Crown Prince Wilhelm was told to put into port as soon as possible because there was just no way to resupply them anymore, and that she was just burning up loads and loads of coal, but just not affecting the shipping as much as they thought she would. Her sister ship, the Kaiser Wilhelm de Gross, which had put to sea in August 1914, was very, very quickly caught by a very old light cruiser, the High Flyer, and destroyed in an afternoon because they just didn't have the armour to defend themselves. And although they had guns and they put up a really good fight, they weren't strong enough to fight a proper warship. And the same happened at the Battle of Trinidad with the Cap Falga. The liners weren't designed for war, and the amount of coal that they consumed was just, it was difficult to keep themselves going. And they found that U-boats were a lot more effective at stopping commerce.
Okay, that's all the questions I have. Thank you for joining.
Cool, thanks very much for having me.